A State Department report on the Keystone XL pipeline says it would not have a significant effect on greenhouse gas emissions. This hour, a look at the politics of that pipeline. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Politics Day, we'll also discuss a new report from the Congressional Budget Office that says the health care law will prompt over 2 million to quit jobs or cut hours. Janet Yellen becomes the first woman to head the Federal Reserve. What's blocking comprehensive immigration reform? Stephen Schmidt and Bruce Nesmith are here to discuss these and other items of political news. Join our discussion after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day has arrived with Stephen Schmidt is in our Ames studio, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Great to have you back, Stephen.
Nice to be on the air with you.
Bruce Nesmith also joining us by phone, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon. We'd like to invite our listeners to join our conversation about any of the numerous topics we're going to be touching on in the political sphere this hour. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. On our docket, gentlemen, a new report from the CBO about the health care law. We'll talk about that a little bit later. New farm bill passing will be signed, I believe, by President Obama on Friday. Janet Yellen, the first woman to head the Federal Reserve. Look at the prospects for comprehensive immigration reform. And did you watch that Bill O'Reilly interview with the president right before the Super Bowl? We'll have some thoughts on that later in the hour. But first, more than 2 million Americans who would otherwise rely on a job for health insurance will quit working, reduce their hours, or stop looking for employment because of the new health care benefits available under the Affordable Care Act. Findings released yesterday from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Republicans took no time to seize on this headline out of the CBO's report that one of the Affordable Care Act's effects is to reduce jobs by nearly 2 million. Here's Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn.
The president's own health care policy is killing full-time work. The Congressional Budget Office said the number of full-time workers will go down by 2 million in the coming years as a result of the Affordable Care Act.
Now, of course, the White House was quick to counter with analysis of its own from chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Jason Furman, who says most of the reduction in employment will be a voluntary decision by workers, not employers.
This is a choice on the part of workers. And I have no doubt that if, for example, we got rid of Social Security and Medicare, there are many 95-year-olds that would choose to work more to avoid potentially starving. I don't think anyone would say that was a compelling argument to eliminate Social Security and Medicare. Similarly here, CBO's analysis itself is about the choices that workers are making in the face of new options afforded to them by the Affordable Care Act, not something about firms destroying jobs.
Okay, so given those two versions of it, let's reach out to our analysts this week, starting with you, Stephen. Is this bad news for the Obama administration, this report?
It's kind of like Governor Christie may have been involved in the closing of the bridge into New York City. Once the headline is out there that says, 2 million jobs down the toilet or people retiring or quitting and not having jobs, that's all that's needed. The arguments below the headline are not consumed by the public. They're only consumed by people like us. So this is just bad news. And I think the White House, to some extent, is always behind the curve. They should have set this whole thing up and said, one of the wonderful benefits of this law is that people who would like to retire and open up that job for younger workers mm-hmm. can now retire because they'll have some affordable health care coverage and they're staying on their job even though they're 70 years old only because they don't want to lose their health insurance policy. So we're going to see some really terrific things coming up in terms of people doing things they really want to do and not have to do things they don't want to do and opening up jobs for new workers. That would have been a positive thing. But the White House waited for this report, and now they're scrambling to try to sort of make the best out of it. It's just bad news for them.
Bruce Nesmith.
I think that this is another example where the communication hasn't been as good as it could have been. Although, you know, when you're dealing with a complex economic reality, and a complex healthcare system, it's hard to get simple messages that aren't somewhat distorted. It is also true that the law contains incentives for employers to reduce full-time work below 30 hours because that is the 30 hours is the magic level at which they must contribute to their employees' health care. My thought was always that if there was a robust enough economy, employers would need the work more than they'd need to avoid the fees. But I don't know that the economy is that robust or that it matters to employers whether they have, you know, three people working 150 hours or six people working those 150 hours in the kinds of work that people do today.
Jack is one of our listeners listening across the border in Moline, Illinois. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Jack. What's your take on this report and how it's being spun by each party?
Well, thank you for letting me speak on this. And what I did want to say is to Professor Schmidt, I want to keep you in line. What you're asking is to shoot the messenger, because the messenger did not give out a perfect message, so shoot him. But the real truth is of the CBR report is that people are free. They do not have to be stuck at a job that has health insurance. They could choose to retire when they're 69, so their spouse who has a pre-existing condition can get her own policy. Mm-hmm. This frees people to be able to then they could decide, well, I don't have to stay this job. I can start my own business.
And you know, Jack,
without the worry to be stuck to this report is positive.
Backing up words, perhaps, Jack, on these airwaves, on this program, you've heard, as we've discussed the Affordable Care Act, people calling up and saying, you know, I have kept this job, which I hate, for years, precisely for that reason. Stephanie, you want to respond to Jack's comment?
Well, I don't want to shoot the Congressional Budget Office, although probably if they had phrased this a little bit differently, the headline would not have read, "Healthcare law will prompt over 2 million to quit jobs or cut hours." I don't want to use the word shoot the White House because that would probably get me an NSA hit right away and I won't be able to do this radio show again. But I do think the Obama administration has been incredibly poor at communicating the benefits of various laws that the Republicans have been much more successful in criticizing and having the momentum in public opinion on. And so, you know, the White House should have been ahead of this because they knew what was coming, really, I think. As your caller said, a lot of people are, in fact, now retiring who couldn't or didn't want to before because of the risk. And that is, as the caller also said, a good thing. So the White House could have made lemonade what is now mostly a lemon for them.
Okay. You don't think there's a chance of reconstituting it as lemonade at this point?
Frozen lemonade, maybe, yeah.
Okay. Hey, Jack, thanks for grooming up a great point and dialing 1-866-780-9100. Jack and Moline, thanks. And before we move on here, let me ask you this, Bruce Nesmith. How much will the ACA, Obamacare, play as a role in the upcoming elections this November? It seems like it's not lost a lot of its steam, political steam.
I think if the election were in the next couple of months, the Republicans would use it, I think, as to kind of follow up on what Stefan's been saying. I think Democrats are having a little bit of trouble talking about it, or figuring out how to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I think as time goes on, I think those situations will change. I think as the law gets more established, it will be harder to argue that it should be repealed and easier to argue that it will be maintained. Whether that situation gets to that point by November, seriously, August, September, when the campaign really kicks in, that's hard to say. So okay. I guess I'm not answering your question.
Well, no, you are. It's a matter of a mm-hmm. timeline and how quickly those narratives develop by November. Final word on that, Stefan, before we move on?
But there have been also some more additional really bad news stories about the Affordable Health Care Act. People who couldn't really get in on a plan that matched their income level, they were told, well, just sign up for this more expensive plan and then go in and make a correction and you'll get a refund. They can't get in to make a connection to get their refund. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of stories, you know, really continue to have, a very negative impact on people's views of this act. So I think it will be a big deal in the next election still.
Stefan Schmidt is with us of Iowa State University, Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. It's Politics Day. Going through a handful of different political developments. So join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. I want to talk about the Keystone XL pipeline now. Long-awaited State Department report on that pipeline found that the pipeline would not have a significant effect on greenhouse gas emissions. The report's logic goes like something like this, Bruce and Stefan. If Keystone XL doesn't get built, the oil extracted from Canada's tar sands will still be transported somehow, maybe by rail, and have the same environmental effect. Environmentalists ramping up their opposition to this proposed nearly 1,200-mile pipeline that will, sort of bisect the lower 48. House Speaker John Boehner became quite animated yesterday. He is a great man for audio clips, by the way, just journalistically speaking. And here's a good example of it. House Speaker John Boehner becoming quite animated yesterday when asked at a news conference about the complexity of the issues surrounding the Keystone Pipeline.
Complex. You think the Keystone Pipeline is complex? It's been under study for 5 years. We build pipelines everywhere in America every day. Do you realize there are 200,000 miles of pipelines in the United States? And the only reason that the president's involved in the Keystone Pipeline is because it crosses an international boundary. Listen, we can build it. There's nothing complex about the Keystone Pipeline. It's time to build it. Bye.
John Boehner, animated is one way to describe him. What are the competing interests, Bruce Nesmith, for the President Obama? And he says, he's not in any rush to make this decision, he says the White House. What are the competing interests for the president in deciding whether or not to build this pipeline?
Well, I think, it comes down to the effects on ordinary people. And if we don't build it, and gasoline prices go up because it's harder to get oil and harder to get it to the refineries, et cetera, then that hits ordinary people in the pocketbook. And even though the gas prices might go up for other reasons or down for other reasons, at that point Obama owns gas prices. By the same token, if they build the pipeline and it leaks what apparently is some really unusually noxious oil into a community and causes evacuations and diseases and things like that, then whoever approved the pipeline owns that leak. So I think those are the critical interests: is how is this going to affect people if we do build it, and how is it going to affect people if we don't build it?
What's Obama's dilemma as you see it, Stefan Schmidt?
He's going to tick off somebody, whether he signs off on this or doesn't sign off on it. And the truth of the matter is that environmentalists would like to score a victory on it. They are deliberately ignoring the fact that, for example, last summer, 4 dozen people were killed in an oil train derailment. I don't know, people probably remember it in Quebec, where an oil train, which was transporting the stuff as opposed to a pipeline, went out of control, rammed into a small town, blew up like a gigantic explosion. And so, and we see the trains going by here all the time on the tracks on our campus. And that's a very unsafe way to transport as well. So we are a carbon-based energy economy still at this point. We're going to want and need oil and gas. There is no happy and good way to move it from one place to another, and it's just a matter of which is better. I have an oil pipeline running through my property. I live on a farm,
You actually do.
It's owned by the Koch brothers, by the way. So, because we get mailings from them about safety,
and they drop off your check there every month.
No, they have an easement many years ago that gave the right to run this oil pipeline from Texas up to Minnesota. It only blew up once, so that's the good news. Not while I was there. It was before then. And there wasn't much of an oil spill. It basically caught on fire and they shut it off and repaired it. So we're basically highly sort of hemmed in on environmental impact of these things because we're so dependent on it. We don't have any other way to get, you know, how would I get to campus if I couldn't buy gasoline? How would I heat my house if I couldn't get propane? And we've got a propane problem going on too. So I think Obama is going to sign this thing. That's my opinion, because what are the environmentalists going to do? Are they going to vote for Rand Paul if he's the Republican candidate? I mean, there's not much choice, is there?
1-866-780-9100. Let's get Jim's view from Iowa City. Jim is listening. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just tuned in and I heard the speaker talking about President Obama owning gas prices if he doesn't approve this. And, of course, that's silly because the oil companies own gas prices. The oil companies are heavily subsidized through the tax
code. He's talking about perception, though, Jim, but go on. Yeah.
Well, okay, I see. That's fine. But by most measures, by building this pipeline, this tar sand oil is released into the international markets by having it piped all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, which then, rather than having it confined to North American markets, opens up its supply chain, and it will probably have the effect of raising gas prices in the United States.
Yeah.
Another thing no one seems to mention very often is what an incredible amount of carbon is added to the atmosphere simply by the extraction of these tar sands oils, not even by burning them, just by extracting them. It's a filthy process, horribly polluting. It's an ecological disaster.
Okay.
The State Department report took note of that, rather graphic note of it. But I think, you know, the assumption is those wacky Canadians are going to do that anyway. So anything we do in terms of building the pipeline isn't going to affect all the gunk that goes in and the carbon that goes into the air by the extraction process.
Okay, Jim.
That's true. We could try to wash our hands up with that excuse.
Yeah.
But we would be complicit if we do build it.
Jim, thanks for your view from Iowa City. We've got another call here. Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Janine. Is it Janine and Tiffin?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, Janine.
I just wanted to say, why not let the Canadians deal with the accidents and the spills and the pollution? Why does it always have to be us? And as far as those refineries down in Texas and Louisiana, I'm sure that everyone there has heard about the awful, terrible pollution of air, water, ground, and how the people who live anywhere close to these refineries.
So you said you think, Janine, just so I'm understanding this right, let them sell their tar sand oil internationally and get it to some port somewhere on their own land.
Well, sure. If it's mainly going to China anyway, let them build their own refineries. And everyone insists that it's got to go by rail, they can build their own pipeline and let them deal with the consequences.
Okay, Janine and Tiffin, thank you very much. 1-866-780-9100. Sally with us. Sally from Marshalltown. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing.
I know we don't have much time. I just wanted to add that there are tremendous complexities to this whole XL pipeline. And the one that is of most concern to me and should be of concern to everyone is the fact that it's going right through or very near to the Ogallala Aquifer, which is a huge, deep underground water supply that supplies most of the West and Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And if that water were to be contaminated, which is not unusual. It's happening in Ohio. It's happening in many places around the country as a result of these types of problems. The other thing is, in Iowa, we also have an issue about mining fracking sand, which is needed for this type of an industry. So it does affect many, many different aspects, not just gas prices and not just a local oil spill. So,
okay,
you know,
so Sally, it sounds like you may, yeah, it sounds like you may have some expertise in this area.
We could be an example. We could be an example and say, no, we're not going to do that, because somebody has to do it first and say no.
Okay. Sally, thanks for your view from Marshalltown. Dwayne is in Marshalltown as well. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi.
Go ahead, please. We're coming up on a break. Please make your point or your question quickly.
The thinking that fellows have right now is primarily on thinking of today with petroleum. There's a little guy called Tesla. He's got a car that goes 280 miles on a charge.
Yes, he does.
And it goes, he can charge it in 20 minutes, and he's going to cover the United States with these chargers, which are solar-powered, and will charge in 20 minutes. You'll have the United States covered in minor ways. By 2014, in September, he covered the whole country of Norway with these, and he sold 500 Teslas in the month of September. These are the $65,000, and he's making a $30,000 car to come out in a couple years.
Okay, so you're saying
By the time you build the pipe time, it'll be obsolete.
Okay, you're saying so get this technology going, and perhaps hand in hand with some conservation, Dwayne.
Yeah.
We have to decide that we don't have to try not to use the car for everything, right?
Well, the technology is there to replace it already. So why subsidize oil? The same in the farms.
Okay.
They forget that all the oil that's used to produce ethanol, and all the oil is produced to produce the corn to make the ethanol,
yep,
is also polluting.
Okay, Dwayne, we're going to move on and get one more call before our break. Thank you, Dwayne from Marshalltown. On the road, Mike, I hope you're driving safely and listening to us. What is your thought on this? We've got a minute before our break.
Okay. The driving is a little challenging, but thank you. I'm listening to you gentlemen speak, and you all seem to be thoughtful, intelligent men. But I think you're just overlooking the most reasonable explanation of this. I think that this pipeline will be held up until the election. And then the president and the people in power will calculate whether to pass it will be beneficial to get them elected, or to hold it up further will be beneficial to hold their power. I listen to studies. For every study you cite, you can cite another study that says the opposite. That's really, I think, the bottom line of this. And I'm interested to hear your take on that. Thank you.
Mike, thanks very much. Let me hand this off to you, Steph. And it sounds like what they used to call real politic. Just it comes down to politics. It'll be put in a scale on either side and find out where it comes out.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the other part is that there is a real concern, I mean, about contamination of groundwater and so on. But it's also true. I actually pulled up a map on the internet of all of the pipelines in the country. And I hope our listeners who have called in so far will go to the internet and pull that same map up. It's unbelievable how many pipelines there are all over the country.
Okay, well, we'll finish up there with the Keystone Pipeline discussion. Moving on after a short break, we'll talk about passage of the Farm Bill, now through the Senate, through both houses of Congress, due to be signed by the president on Friday. We'll talk about that when we come back. Also, the first ever woman to head the Federal Reserve. Let's remind ourselves, what's the Federal Reserve all about anyway? Immigration, chances for comprehensive reform in 2014. We'll get Bruce and Stefan's view on that when we return. We hope you join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more in just a few minutes. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa is the only Midwestern state where commercial dog racing remains legal and active, but that may soon change as state lawmakers look at proposals to end greyhound racing at the only tracks left in Iowa. Those are in Dubuque and Council Bluffs. Tomorrow on this program, we'll take a look at greyhound racing's history in the state, its impact on communities with tracks, how these tracks are subsidized, and the future of greyhound racing in Iowa. Hope you'll join us tomorrow on the program to talk about dog racing, greyhound racing. Today, pack of dogs of a different sort politics. And Stefan Schmidt and Bruce Nesmith with us. There's a tie in there somewhere. I didn't quite achieve it, did I, Stefan?
It was a nice try.
Pretty good job.
Valiant attempt. Let's talk about the farm bill before we talk about a few other things in politics. The Senate has voted with strong bipartisan support to end send a $1 trillion farm bill to the White House for President Obama's signature. I believe that's due Friday. The Senate voted 68-32 to approve this five-year agricultural and food bill following a Republican House vote. That was last week. U.S. Agriculture Secretary, former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack on MSNBC this week defended the farm program spending contained in the farm bill as necessary for protecting farmers from unreasonable risk.
They reduce the risk of farming. If you think about farming today, whether it's dealing with sub-zero weather, whether it's dealing with a snowfall that occurred in October and basically wiped out livestock operations in the Dakotas, Mother Nature sometimes doesn't cooperate. And the bottom line is that that can result in people going out of business because it's expensive to farm. The reason why we're a food secure nation is because we have extraordinarily productive people that stay in the business of farming. So we benefit as consumers and as Americans by having people farm. They don't have to farm.
Some of the big numbers from the new farm bill: total estimated cost over 10 years, $1 trillion. Total savings compared to the current law, between 16 and $23 billion. Direct payments to farmers are out. More crop insurance subsidies, those are in. The final legislation cuts the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, known as SNAP, by $8 billion. So, Bruce Nesmith, the Congress is now capable of compromising and approving legislation, at least on this point. It took a while.
Yes. Yes, it did. But they got it done. It seems kind of, I would call it kind of a lowest common denominator compromise as opposed to one that advances interests on both sides. But they did get it done.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, why did it take so long to reach agreement, 2 years?
Well, because there was significant pushback, especially from the most conservative Republicans in the House, who really, really don't like food stamps. They think that they are for slackers and that they, you know, are a disincentive for people to work. And so they wanted to split the farm bill in two, take the food stamps out. And you have to remember that out of that whole package of $1 trillion, I think over 70% is actually food stamps.
I've heard even 80%.
Or 80%. So you call it a farm bill. It's actually a bill that incorporates support and programs for agriculture, but the bulk of it is really to provide people with basically nutritional assistance. And by separating it out, the Republicans were hoping then to be able to make it much more difficult to support this enormous, it's about $70 billion a year to help low-income people buy food. So it's even with the cut that they did, it's still $70 billion a year. So that's a huge program. And they had the vote in the House and voted to split it. And, of course, the Democrats controlled the Senate, so that wasn't going to fly. And eventually, I think they just wore out. And this is clearly a loss for the most fiscally conservative Republicans. They lost that part of it. Senator Grassley voted against this bill for some other subsidies that are still in it. But in the end, I would say that, you know, this is a sausage, and watching a sausage being made with all the trimmings that are picked off the floor and shoved into it is an ugly business, and it's an ugly farm bill, but it's going to work. It always has worked, and we have some of the cheapest food in the world, and we have some of the most prosperous farmers, and it's partly because we have provided all these support programs, and we do provide an enormous amount of free food to a lot of low-income people. So, I guess it's the best we can do. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Janet Yellen, in other political developments this past week, sworn in as the first woman to head the Federal Reserve. Yellen took the oath in a brief ceremony on Monday, reported by the Associated Press, in front of a fireplace at the Fed's massive boardroom. Her husband is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He was present there. According to the AP, the 67-year-old Yellen made no remarks at her swearing-in, but did smile to acknowledge the applause of the assembled group. Her chair ends February 2018. Bruce, can you remind us what the Federal Reserve does?
Well, pretty much their idea is to smooth out bumps in the economy. They're created in 1913 after a long period where the U.S. had gone without any kind of national economic institution since the Bank of the United States was ended in the 1832, I think. And pretty much their idea is to the point is to manage the money supply and otherwise sort of smooth out the economic cycle so that the busts aren't quite as devastating.
Stefan, any reason to believe that Yellen will decide or lead this group any differently than her predecessor?
Let me point out that the minute that she was sworn in, the stock market went down significantly. And that's because she is going to continue slowly pulling back essentially the enormous amount of money that the Federal Reserve has been pumping into the economy by buying debt. And so there is, I mean, I don't really know, but everybody that has written about this and knows her says that it's going to be Bernanke light and that she's going to continue the policies that the Fed has been following. And the consequences of that are going to be that a lot of people are going to get jittery because our economy is fairly soft. And the essentially what the Fed has been pumping into the economy has been very helpful to create jobs and to some extent increase consumer confidence. But the Fed, there are some people who want to do away with it. You know, Ron Paul wanted to do away with the Fed and go back to the gold standard and so on. Every country in the world has a central bank, and the Fed is basically our central bank, which does watch very carefully when the economy slows down too much. They try to stimulate it, which they've now been doing, you know, for 6 years. Or 5 years, and when the economy gets too wild and exuberant and inflation gets out of control, they raise interest rates and cut the money supply to get people to kind of stop buying stuff and overheating the economy. So right. there's kind of sort of, you know, a monitor of the cycles of the economy.
Let's talk about immigration reform quickly before we move on back in discussion. Support for some kind of change to the immigration system by Democrats and some Republicans, but the GOP is divided on immigration. Bruce, what are the divisions for the GOP on this issue?
Well, I think the perception has been, I think it's correct, that that immigration is a issue of huge concern among Latinos. And while that's kind of the word Latino is kind of a made up word, it does seem to be an issue that unites the various ethnic groups that come from South America and Central America, and unites people who are who have been here legally for a long time with people who are not legally here, and so the Republicans have not done well among Latinos in general, other than, you know, since the 1990s. And there are some people who consider that to be a matter of considerable political concern and other people who feel that it's not a matter of political concern as much as sticking with the rules that we've got.
Mm-hmm. Some conservatives advising Republicans, Stefan, to hold off on immigration reform, at least in the short term. Is there a window in 2014, perhaps after the primaries, with which we could find enough consensus to pass something?
I'm not sure, because I think that we all have fallen for the analysis that immigration reform is what drives the Latino voters in the United States, or Hispanic voters. They're still called Hispanics in the census. And, you know, really, Latino voters, like everyone else, are driven by whether there are jobs, whether there are good jobs, how the school system is doing, are their kids safe in school, are they, you know, breathing clean air and getting access to some health care. And so there are lots of other issues on which the Republicans have basically alienated the Hispanic voters who believe that government can do good. I mean, you know, there are a lot of Americans who believe that government is there to help improve the lives of people and that it's not evil and that it helps to basically open opportunities. And the Republican Party is not very, good on immigration, but they're also not at all good on many of these other issues. You know, they're opposed to health care. They want to privatize Social Security. And so the Hispanic Latino community has been voting more heavily Democratic because that party has a package of ideas and policies and proposals that are more consistent with what Latino voters feel is important.
Mm-hmm. But your prediction briefly on whether,
so.
Whether
I don't
you don't
so.
See it in 2014.
No, I don't think so, because I think a lot of Republicans in the districts from which they get elected in the House, for example, and maybe even senators, don't see that passing an immigration bill is going to do anything except anger the base of their party, which is very much opposed to most immigration. And what they want to pass as an immigration bill is basically a national security bill to militarize the Mexican border and increase border security. And, you know, that's not going to get them any votes to deport more people and put more drones and National Guard and others on the Mexican border. And that seems to be where they're holding out. And so I frankly don't think that the Republicans feel it's going to help them get elected or reelected or that it's good policy. And I think they're going to resist it, and they are resisting it. They came out of their last confab where they were supposed to kumbaya and find some unity. They came out of there on immigration pretty much exactly as divided as they went in. So,
mm-hmm. Bruce, mm-hmm. quickly, do you see immigration getting through Congress this year?
No, I don't.
Okay. Enough said on that. Let's go to some interesting fundraising numbers before the hour ends, reported by the Sioux City Journal concerning the race for Iowa's 4th District. This is 4th District, if you can picture Iowa, so the northwest corner, and also a central part of the state. Incumbent Representative Steve King, Republican, raising significantly less money for his 2014 reelection campaign than he did for the last election. His Democratic challenger this time raising more money than King for the second consecutive quarter. The challenger, Democratic candidate Jim Maurer, an Iraq war veteran, former Pentagon official. King has served in Congress since 2003. He remains a favorite in the Republican-leaning district. Is this fundraising difference significant? Stephen Schmidt, we're still saying this is a safe district for the GOP, aren't we?
Much less safe than it was before.
Why?
This is a new district. You know, Congressman King is my congressman. He represents Ames and Story County and this area, which was not in there before. I think the rural population has been declining in the 4th District very significantly. It's the fastest declining, I think, of the sort of regions in Iowa. And small-town rural conservative voters have been the base of his vote. And I think that Steve King is suddenly finding that some of the things that he said, which, you know, sometimes he says them sort of in humor, have actually sort of alienated, especially independent voters.
But this was true in the last race when it was redistricted and we had Ames as a part of the 4th District and we had Iowa's former First Lady running against Steve King.
Yeah, and she ran a lousy campaign and Steve King won re-election by the smallest margin of any election he's ever run. So I think he'll win, but I think we're going to see more money hurled at him. You know, even in the national news media, very often Steve King is sort of used as the straw man of, you know, what Republicans shouldn't be saying and what costs Republicans a lot of independent voters. So,
do you see that as well, Bruce?
I was going to ask Stephen, what's Story County's voting history? I mean, they're surely not as Democratic as Johnson County, where Iowa City is.
No, we're not the Socialist Republic of Story County, but you know, it's mixed. I mean, they're. It leans Democratic. Most of our representatives in the legislature are Democrats. And so, and it's a significant source of revenue. So I'm sure that Maurer is getting a bunch of checks written by, people higher income people in Story County. It's going to be an interesting race.
Plenty of months before that election in November. One last thing, gentlemen, before we go. President Obama, of course, talking politically this week. He was part of the lead up to the Super Bowl over the weekend. He sat down with Fox News's Bill O'Reilly for an interview before that big game, a free-ranging conversation lasting all of 10 minutes, covering topics like the failed rollout of the Affordable Care Act website, the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya, also the IRS scandal. O'Reilly asked the president why former IRS chief Douglas Shulman made 157 visits to the White House. Shulman resigned in November, and allegations the IRS unfairly targeted conservative groups for increased scrutiny of the 501c4 organizations. The president said Shulman was involved in the health care rollout and numerous other projects that required the presence at the White House meetings. Here's part of the exchange about that between Bill O'Reilly and the president.
So you had all these different agendas in which the head of the IRS is naturally involved.
Did you speak to him a lot yourself?
I do not recall meeting with him in any of these meetings that are pretty routine meetings.
Okay, so you don't recall seeing Shulman, because what some people are saying is that the IRS was used at a local level in Cincinnati, maybe other places, to
absolutely
go after.
Absolutely wrong.
But how do you know that? Because we still don't know what happened there.
Bill, we do. That's not what happened. Folks have, again, had multiple hearings on this. I mean, these kinds of things keep on surfacing, in part because you and your TV station will promote them.
But when folks actually... Don't you feel there are unanswered questions?
Bill, when you actually look at the stuff, there have been multiple hearings on it. What happened here was you've got a 501c4 law that people think is confusing. No, that the folks did not know how to implement.
Okay.
Because it basically says...
So you're saying
there was no
corruption there at all? No.
That's not what I'm saying. That's actually...
No, but I want to know what you're saying. You're the leader
absolutely.
Of the country. You're saying no corruption?
No.
None?
No. There were some boneheaded decisions.
Boneheaded decisions.
Out of a
but
local
no
office.
Mass corruption?
Not even mass corruption. Not even a smidgen of corruption, obviously.
Okay.
Okay, Bill O'Reilly there with the president prior to the Super Bowl. The president there with a jab at Fox News. Bruce Nesmith, we have just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye for the hour. What did you think? What do you think of this tradition before the Super Bowl and of that particular interview?
Well, you know, I think it says something to Obama's supporters that he's willing to go on Fox News, and the people at Fox News can feel good about seeing the president and showing that they're not just living in a bubble, and so it shows that we're at least talking to each other, or at least talking in the same room as each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that anything Obama could have said is going to convince people who believe that there was a conspiracy that there was not a conspiracy. But you know, he's got to say that, and I think what he said was pretty much accurate as far as the external thing. I don't know what went on in the White House.
Stephen Schmidt?
It's a useless tradition. I mean, what does the Super Bowl have to do with the president getting interviewed by a hostile reporter? I think we ought to put an end to that and get right to the pregame show.
Isn't the agreement that the president has agreed to give an interview to the network that has the Super Bowl of any particular year?
Why?
A lot of eyeballs and then there's a lot of ears.
People watching the Super Bowl didn't watch that. They were out as soon as Obama and O'Reilly came out. O'Reilly supporters may have watched it and cheered him on. But the rest of us went to the kitchen to see if those little hot dogs in the barbecue sauce were warm enough yet to put a couple of toothpicks in them. And O'Reilly didn't do anything different than he has done without the president sitting there. And, of course, the IRS is used by any president who has half a brain to go after his political enemies. That's what the Internal Revenue Service is there for, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm being sarcastic.
The program started in 2007. Was Bush going after conservative groups?
No, liberal groups.
Was that a question that either one of you went on to answer? No. Okay. Let's take the last minute to just say what's on the political horizon. What are you looking for in the next week or so, Bruce?
I'm very interested to see how the issues that came out of last week get worked on. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to happen this week, but over time, as to what extent Democrats and Republicans are willing to work together to achieve some kind of common goal. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Stefan?
I want to see how many more stinkers come out of the woodwork and take the Fifth over Chris Christie's Bridgegate. So we're all sitting on the edge of our seats to see, you know, who's going to rat on him and right. whether his political career is really over.
He's right, certainly... right. One headline I saw said, forget the 2016 aspirations. We have to see if he keeps his job as governor. So you're in that category.
Yes, I am. And there's even talk about, you know, impeachment and jail time. But I doubt if it'll go that far. But already the Iowans who went to try to recruit him are beginning to abandon the ship. The Register, Des Moines Register, had a big article about that. So that's not a good sign.
Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Bruce Nesmith, Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Political Science at Coe College. Bruce, Stefan, always a pleasure. Thank you both.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks. Good show.
Okay. And tomorrow on this program, another a look at commercial dog racing in the state, which remains legal and active in Dubuque and in Council Bluffs. We'll look at the future of that tomorrow. If you've been to some dog races in the state, we'd like to have you join our conversation. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.